It is now 10 minutes after 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Over the years of my hosting WGTD's morning show, I have read and then spoken with the authors of many interesting books about the Kennedy family. But I'm not sure I have ever read a book about the Kennedys that was as engrossing as the book that we're going to be talking about today. It's the latest book by prolific author Neil Thompson. The book is titled The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. And in this book, we are meeting in remarkably vivid detail the first generation of the Kennedy family to come to the United States. And in humble beginnings indeed, that doesn't begin to describe the difficulties that were faced by Bridget and Patrick Kennedy. And it makes the sort of overarching story of the Kennedy family and subsequent generations all the more remarkable. Neil Thompson has given us several really interesting books before that, including Hurricane Season, A Coach, His Team, and Their Triumph in the Time of Katrina, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley, and Kickflip Boys, A Memoir of Freedom, Rebellion, and the Chaos of Fatherhood. This latest book, published by Mariner Books, an imprint of HarperCollins, is, again, The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. Neil Thompson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, that's quite a setup, Greg. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to talking about the book, and I'm happy to be here.
I'm so glad we can have this chance to talk. One thing that I neglected to mention in what I just said about you is that this is, in a sense, an intensely personal book for you to write. That is, the experience of this first generation of Kennedys in America touches on some of your own family background as well. Explain that very personal connection.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on it, because I think that personal connection is why it took me almost 20 years to figure out how to write this book. The origins of this thing go back, and I write about it in the opening pages of the book, but they go back more than 20 years to 1999 when JFK Jr. died. I was a newspaper reporter working for the Baltimore Sun and was sent up to Cape Cod to the Kennedy compound at Hyannisport to await word on what was happening with JFK. He was at that time missing, and then they found his plane, and I was in a bar with a bartender who started crying when we learned that JFK Jr. had died. And so I was part of the chaos of that coverage. And you mentioned the name of what I would soon learn were the first Kennedys, Bridget and Patrick. And after I'm driving back from Hyannisport for that story and JFK Jr.'s death, I drive by through New Jersey, not far from the cemetery that held my grandparents, Bridget and Patrick, who were also Irish immigrants. And so the idea, or at least the nugget of an idea, started back in 1999. For years after that, I tried to find a way in. What's really the story here? Is it a personal story? Is it a way for me to explore my own Irish heritage and the connections between my Irish immigrant grandparents and the Kennedy ancestors who experienced similar discrimination and all kinds of hardship coming to a country that didn't necessarily want them? other books, some of which you just mentioned, kept intruding. But it was just a few years ago, not too long after the election of 2016, when I started hearing word for word some of the same rhetoric around immigration and keep them out and build a wall and the things we're all familiar with now, and realizing those were the same words that were used against Irish immigrants in the Kennedy's day. And that's when I've realized, even though this is a personal story to me, and I do touch on it in the very beginning and the end of the book, it's a universal story about what it's like to come to a new land and what it's like to feel so alone, confronting a nation that doesn't necessarily want you, which I was shocked to find was truly the situation for the first Kennedys going back two generations before JFK. Hmm. So the personal kind of meshed with the historical for me, and it was kind of an ideal project for me to dive into, as well as digging back into a story we thought we all knew. It's something I've done with other books. What's really the backstory? How did this all really begin?
Hmm. As you say in the book's introduction, it was not until the death of JFK Jr. that that something aroused your simmering Irishness. You tell us that really before this, you had not thought too deeply about your Irish roots. So this just, I mean, this was who you were, and yet it wasn't something that, in a sense, you had done much reflecting upon, apparently.
Yeah, not necessarily. Even though I grew up, I'm Irish on one side of my family, on my mother's, is first generation Irish, and I was raised in an Irish Catholic community. I was surrounded by Quinns and Murphys and O'Gormans, and you know, half the town seemed like they were Irish descended. So you would think I would have some sense of that heritage. I just didn't. I mean, my dad went to Notre Dame, so I rooted for Notre Dame. I went to church on Sunday, but I didn't worship the Kennedys like some Irish Catholic families did. We didn't have a picture of JFK on the wall growing up. So it was there, but this sense of, as you described from the book, my Irishness, but it was kind of latent. It didn't really awaken, I would say, until later in life.
Mm.
And, you know, I look back now and think I wish I had asked my Irish grandmother, Bridget, who went by the name Della, wish I had asked her more about what her experience was. But, you know, as a kid, you don't think about these things until it's too late.
A lot of us feel that sort of regret. Well, I'm glad that that all of this came together in a way that galvanized you at last to write this this tremendously interesting book. My understanding is that you were given sort of unprecedented access to certain private papers in the Kennedy family that really helped to make this book as sort of richly illuminating as it is. Explain the nature of those private papers, where they are housed, how you gained access, and what kind of value they were to you.
Yeah, the challenge I discovered or ran into early on with this project was that the people I'm writing about, Bridget Murphy Kennedy and Patrick Kennedy, who came here in the 1840s after the potato famine started to ravage the country, they didn't leave behind letters and memoirs. They were poor immigrants just trying to keep their family together. And so there wasn't initially a whole lot of easily accessible material about them or their children. I had many years ago, when this idea first arose, contacted the John F. Kennedy Library just south of Boston to ask them what kind of information they had about the early Kennedys. And there was some, and they sent me some very valuable documentation that they've digitized. I visited the library and was able to access some additional information. So through that access and cooperation with the JFK Library, I started to collect some of the material I needed. I also traveled to Ireland and visited the homestead where Patrick Kennedy was born and raised. But there was always a little bit missing, and I knew from probably 2016 or 17 that the JFK Library held the personal papers of P.J. Kennedy, who was JFK's grandfather. And I started, call it politely asking, borderline nagging the library to open those up and provide access to those. And they are a hardworking crew and super generous, but these papers were old and fragile. Many of them were onion skin paper. So they kept explaining to me that it's a delicate process. They have to be scanned and digitized off-site. And as a federal agency, they have to go through these proper steps. So every year, sometimes twice a year, maybe three times, I would contact the head archivist there and say, hey, just checking in again. Anything happening with the PJ papers? And that it kept getting delayed. And I think that probably contributed to the delay in my committing myself fully to this project. But it was probably, I think, 2018 or 19 that they said, okay, we're going to do this. It's in our next fiscal calendar. We're going to focus on getting these papers done. And they got started, and things were looking good, and I was getting ready to go visit to see them in person because that's what they prefer. And then COVID hit, and things ground to a halt, and I was terrified that this was going to affect my project. I was pretty far along at that point and feel like I had enough to write the story even without those papers. But then, thankfully, again, with more nagging on my part, the archivist said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We still have more to process because it's slow going, but we're going to give you access to the first two-thirds or half. And they sent me this file, and I practically cried when I received the file of all these documents that were letters, personal letters, business documents that P.J. Kennedy had left behind. I know we'll get to his story soon and talk in more detail about his political career and his business career and how he, in my view, is kind of an overlooked figure, as was his mother in the Kennedy saga. But those papers really helped me get inside the head of P.J. Kennedy and learn a little bit more about his character, what kind of person he was, how giving he was to the community, how he loaned money to other incoming Irish immigrants, how he wrote letters of recommendation to try and find jobs for incoming Irish immigrants. He was really a kind of a community organizer. And I argue in the book, he gets that sensibility from his mother, Bridget, who deeply influenced him and deeply influenced his career. So those papers really kind of were not a cherry on top of the research, but they really added some depth to my ability to bring him and his mother to life in ways that they hadn't been before.
We're speaking with Neil Thompson, author of The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. Interestingly enough, your book, after its introduction, does not begin at the start of the story, but 10 years after the start of the story, a really crucial moment in this story in November of 1858. The prologue of your book begins when Bridget Murphy Kennedy buries her husband, Patrick. I think it's a brilliant choice. Explain why you think it's a great way to sort of frame the story that follows. Why is this moment so crucial?
Yeah, thanks for picking up on that, because I've wrestled with that a lot. How do I introduce a book about a family that most of us think we know and many readers might be maxed out on, you know. You said yourself that you've read many Kennedy books over the years, as have I. And so I wanted to open the book with something unique and revealing, primarily revealing about the character of Bridget Kennedy. I didn't want to necessarily start with the potato famine and the dangerous crossing that many Irish emigrants made to escape their crumbling homeland. That story's been done, and I was wary of repeating some of the excellent work of previous historians around the famine and the coffin ships that they arrived on and that kind of thing. But I wanted to introduce readers right away to who Bridget was and what she was up against. And that scene is really one of the darker moments of an already pretty dim life to date. Mid-1850s, she's made it to America, she's gotten married and started her family, but she's already lost one son to disease because they live in these crowded, disease-ridden tenement buildings, in their case in East Boston, across from an island across from downtown Boston. And then she loses her husband as well. And he's left her with very little money. She's working as a maid, like many Irish women did when they came to America, like my grandmother did when she came to America. And what's going to happen to her? I wanted to tease out the terror that she must have faced and her kids must have faced when they're putting Patrick into the ground. And I also wanted to tease up the depth of the discrimination that they faced, which forced Bridget to bury Patrick in west of Boston in Cambridge, because Catholics weren't allowed to be buried in the city of Boston at that time. There was such an anti-Irish, anti-Catholic sentiment among the blue bloods and Brahmins who controlled the city of Boston at that time. There was only one Catholic cemetery, and it was full and often under kind of constant assault by lawmakers to try and shut it down completely. So she had no choice but to leave the city, make this slow carriage ride west to Cambridge to put her husband in the ground. Hopefully it sets up a number of the themes of the book, that opening scene, as well as showing Bridget's personality that she started with an extremely tall hill to climb when she came to America, and then it just got worse.
This is just a brief excerpt from the end of the prologue, which I think is a really great example of your beautiful writing. So this is at the graveside of her husband. Had it all been a mistake, thinking she could start a full new life in America? She has no choice now but to return to the job she took on when she'd arrived 10 years earlier. She'll go back to serving others, a domestic, a biddy, a maid. Her husband's death might have marked a tipping point into a tragic descent, into a lifetime as an overworked maid, watching as her daughters became servants too, and her son an underpaid dock worker, all of them destined to die young and poor among the reviled hordes of refugees. Instead, in a remarkable display of drive and resilience over the next decade, Bridget will march from strength to strength. That's just a beautiful way to set up what is indeed an exciting and remarkable story. Again, we're talking with Neil Thompson about his newest book, The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty. You've already made brief mention, and you certainly describe it in vivid detail, the way in which Ireland was decimated by the infamous potato famine. But you tell us towards the beginning of chapter one that, unlike many others who stepped onto whatever ship carried her to America, you write, Bridget Murphy was not leaving home to escape starvation. She was driven to this moment by a different kind of hunger. Explain that different kind of hunger that was inspiring Bridget to take this gigantic leap of faith.
Yeah, what I love about this job, when I'm able to do it fully, as I was with this book, is learning more about bits of history that I thought I knew, and then just always learning how little I actually knew. So with the potato famine, I knew the general broad outlines. The potato crops died across the country. Farmers who were tenant farmers, most of them across Ireland, because the land was owned by English landlords. They were decimated because they had to grow crops to pay their own rent, and the potato crops were what they lived off of. That's what they ate. So it was a complicated thing when the primary source of sustenance for their families is gone. So broad outlines, a thousand or a million people died give or take, and at least a million, perhaps as many as 2 million people fled the country. Just a scenes of chaos and desperation. It was incredible how quickly that that famine ravaged the country. Bridget and her family were farmers and not well off, but they didn't starve to death. They were able to hold on to their farm. But you're right, and you pick up on an interesting piece of the story of Bridget. It's not. She didn't maybe necessarily have to leave because of starvation or some of the other desperate measures that people were facing. Bridget left because she wanted to leave. You know, Ireland was, even before the famine, was not a hopeful place for young women. If they were lucky, they'd find a farmer to marry and raise their kids on a rented farm, maybe just an acre or so. That was the life she was kind of destined for in Ireland. So a lot of women, I wouldn't say a lot, but there were women like Bridget who decided that this was a good, this was their chance to get out. We don't know exactly what she was thinking at the time because she didn't leave us letters, but I do think she was part of this core group of women who saw the famine as an opportunity to get out of Ireland and start a new life and hopefully get to a place like America and start making some money and send it back home to help the family, which is what Bridget did. But I think that that initial escape from Ireland says a lot about her, and I use the word hunger there because I think you see that throughout the rest of her life. She was hungry for more. She didn't want to settle for what she was initially destined for, either a poor farmer's wife or, in America, a poor widowed maid. She was always striving for something more than her due. And then you see that through the rest of her life, and I think it trickles down through the bloodline as well.
At the end of chapter one, we read these words, "A generation of Bridgets chose to take a chance on a new dawn rather than wait for marriage in an ancient land run by church and queen. Many left home, wings wide with a sense of adventure, optimism, and purpose, believing they could accomplish things in America that Ireland would surely have quashed. In Ireland, a woman was powerless, voiceless. In the United States of America, perhaps she'd find independence and a chance to speak her mind. Better to start anew and afar, if she could just survive the 3,000 miles of ocean." Those last words set up the chapter in the book that I was really not prepared for, this chapter called Bridget at Sea, in which you imagine the kind of harrowing voyage across the Atlantic, which she and so many others endured. And, of course, we don't even know specifically the ship on which Bridget made this journey to America, but we know a lot about what this voyage was like for so many others, and it's just unimaginable. And one of the things you tell us, this leapt out at me, is that for someone who was Irish traveling to America on a British ship, which I think is most often what would happen, that they already, even before they reached America, were facing terrible discrimination and mistreatment because they were Irish. I mean, in other words, that bigotry was already there when they'd scarcely left the dock. We don't have a lot of time, I'm afraid, to talk about this, but just maybe summarize just a little bit of what one reads in this chapter of Bridget's story.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one thing about Bridget, it says a lot about who she was, that she would willingly put herself in that situation on these ships that were, by the time she left, were well known for the disease aboard those ships and the harsh treatment by the English captains and crew. You know, it took at least a month, sometimes twice as long, at sea to get from Liverpool, which is where many of those ships left from, to get to Boston or New York or New Orleans or Baltimore. And the horrors that they faced at sea are, it's another piece of the story that I knew bits of, but once I drilled down deep and found other sources from that period of time, first-person accounts of what it was like to be aboard these ships, it was terrifying. Illness, mistreatment by the crew, not enough provisions. They're sleeping below decks in these tiny little bunks, sometimes two to a bunk. I think it was a two-foot-wide shelf that they were giving, but sometimes there had to be two people sleeping on that shelf. Icebergs gouging these ships, fires sinking them, and so many deaths across the journey that bodies were just wrapped in sailcloth and tossed overboard. There's one account that I quote from where one of these passengers describes it as plunk, 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 just these bodies getting dropped into the ocean day after day. So it took a lot. It took a pretty significant commitment to say, I'm going to put myself in that situation just so I can get to America. And, hopefully it's resonant of the today's situations in certain countries that are facing their own challenges, and you realize why people are putting themselves in those kinds of situations, crossing borders, getting into rickety boats to escape, because they're so hungry, like Bridget was, for a new start.
And one of the things that's quite remarkable is that it is so many women, more women than men, who are willingly, or at least to some extent, many of them willingly subjecting themselves to this extraordinary peril. You write, Irish women led the way west, outnumbering male emigres in a female-dominated migration, making the Irish the only 19th-century immigrant group with more women than men. Can you explain why that would be so?
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting factors going on there, one of which was that the Irish married later than some other countries. They often postponed marriage until, late 20s or even 30, partly because there just wasn't enough money to go around or enough jobs, so men and women were always working until a little bit later in life before they either found a spouse or decided it was time to settle down. But in the case of the famine, the women were the first to say, I'm out of here. Like we described with Bridget's situation, they didn't have great prospects if they had stayed in Ireland, and so many of them decided either to just flee and get away, or sort of hopeful view of it was that they decided, I'm going to go to America and start anew and see what it's like, get settled, and then I'll call for my, siblings or parents and relatives to come over. But I'll be the one to go over and sort of put the stake in the ground. And remarkably, and it says a lot about the strength and grit of Irish women like Bridget, many of the women chose to play that role, to be the first to cross over to America and get things started. So just one of many what I found revelations about the specific circumstances of the Irish facing the tragedy of that famine is that the women were the ones who raised their hand and said, all right, I'll go. I'll take this on. I'm going to do this.
Wow, incredible. You've already touched on the fact that much of this story has a resonance with today and the plight of refugees all around the globe. I found another fairly recent or current resonance in the opening of the fourth chapter, which is Bridget in the City, where we get a sense of what Bridget Murphy may have experienced when she first reached these shores and reached the city of Boston. You write there, for many, life in America, that is for these emigres, began with a scramble to connect with relatives or friends who preceded them. Irish immigrants in Boston grabbed the latest copy of the Boston Pilot and turned to the information wanted section, full of items from and about the disconnected diaspora. These advertisements, subsequently known as the Searching for Missing Friends ads, could be placed at a cost of $1 for 4 weeks. They read like the collective anxieties of immigrants across time and place. Any information, dead or alive, will thankfully be received for such and such. Arrived in America about 2 years since and have not heard from such and such. And so on. Thousands of such pleas appeared in the pilot through the mid-19th century, mostly from famine immigrants looking for sons and daughters, long-lost siblings, co-workers, or errant husbands. I'm reminded a little bit of those heartbreaking paper placards that dotted New York City in the wake of 9/11, and the plight of people who are desperate for information, and in so many cases, information that maybe never comes, or questions that are ultimately never answered. And what you remind us is that for so many who made this perilous voyage across the Atlantic, one of the worst things about it was just the terrible limbo of not knowing what had become of loved ones who had attempted that voyage and so on. Or once they get here, desperate to try to find people with whom to connect. Fortunately for Bridget, she was able to make those connections with loved ones who were already here.
Yeah, I just got a chill when you mentioned 9/11. I hadn't really thought about those, you know, posters that we all saw searching for missing loved ones. And I guess, you know, you see those at other times and places when there's a, you know, large-scale loss of life and people are just frantically trying to find someone who's missing. And, you know, obviously today it's easier to connect. We're so digitized and globally connected, but I can't imagine what it would be like back in Bridget's day to just show up on the shore of a new country and, you know, these docks, I described them briefly in the book, when the ships pull up, there are just scammers everywhere and it's crowded and noisy and confusing and it's just bedlam. And you're alone, as she was, and just running around trying to find a familiar face. And, you know, it says a lot that people would put themselves in that position back at that time, but you know, she worked it out. She, as you mentioned, she did find family members and she did get settled, but those first days and weeks must have been terrifying. You know, she had never left the family farm or been far from the family farm, and suddenly she's in a city that's, you know, hundreds of times larger than her rural village in Ireland. So her world was just cracked wide open. And you know, there wasn't a lot of, even though she did connect with some family members, it's not like there was a large support network that welcomed her and said, okay, here's how things work here in America. She had to figure it out on her own.
And, of course, as she went looking for work, as she had to do, she was confronted by all kinds of ads that might say, wanted a good, reliable woman to take care of a boy 2 years old, good wages, no washing or ironing. Positively no Irish need apply. You tell us that eventually these ads were so numerous that they earned their own acronym, NINA, N-I-N-A, no Irish need apply. That's just like a stake through the heart. I mean, it's just hard to imagine what that would feel like to be an Irish immigrant here in America and seeing those signs everywhere. Can you just help us understand the sort of the heart of that sort of animosity? What was driving that widespread prejudice against the Irish?
You know, it's a great question, and I explore a lot of that theme throughout the book. In a word, fear. You know, fear of the newcomer, fear of someone who's different from you, fear of someone who talks differently from you, and in particular, when it came to the Irish who were Catholic, fear of someone who worships a different God than you. And, you know, unfortunately, it says a lot about our nation. We think of ourselves as a nation of immigrants, and we, in fact, are, but kind of despite ourselves, we are. At that time, folks in Boston, which is the city I focus on mostly, because that's where the Kennedys ended up, but this was happening elsewhere. The citizens were terrified of the Irish or mad at the Irish or afraid of the Irish. You know, it was the... Bridget was part of the first large-scale wave of immigrants to America. You know, people have been coming here from countries across the world since the earliest days, and there were no laws that restricted that. If you could get here, you could walk through the door. But in the 1850s, when this very large wave of Irish started to arrive on the shores, that triggered this xenophobia and nativism that had kind of been around for many years, maybe from the very beginning of our colonizing this land that wasn't ours. But it flared up in the 1850s when nativist groups became organized and their sentiments became normalized. And so I was shocked and actually saddened at times to see some of the same words that we've heard in recent years about send them back and these dirty Irish are coming to take your jobs and let's build a wall and all these same words that we have heard more recently. But I think what was behind it was, you know, we were, this country was settled by immigrants from England, and so there's been and continues to be a very Anglo-centric, very WASPy, very Protestant foundation here. So when the Irish came, they came from this land that the English hated. You know, the English had conquered Ireland. I described some of the attitudes that the English held toward Ireland and the Irish. They hated them over there, too. So these reviled Irish now show up on these very WASPy Protestant shores, and the Bostonians, the old school Bostonians, just didn't want them. And so that was what Bridget was up against. you know, pretty soon there are efforts to start making laws to keep the Irish down and out, to make it harder for them to vote, to keep them out of elected office. All these efforts to delegitimize them and their experience and keep them either out of the country or, if they couldn't do that, at least at the lowest rungs of the economic ladder, which is where Bridget, you know, wallowed for many years.
Right. She does, of course, find work as a domestic, and you describe in really interesting detail what her experience likely was and for others doing that same kind of work at that point in time. And then, of course, ultimately, she meets the man she would ultimately marry, Patrick Kennedy. You say at one point, they were nobodies who found each other, just two refugees competing to make it in America alongside immigrants from around the globe. Whether they courted and married for love or convenience or through a family arrangement, no matter. They'd start a small life together, just blocks from the wharves where they'd arrived, never to return to Ireland. They also would never see more than a few square miles of their new country. I remember reading, I think, that Patrick Kennedy was the only one of his siblings to ever leave Ireland. And
right.
I don't think there's a photograph of him that exists. You have lots of photographs in your book, but there is none of Patrick Kennedy. And, of course, there's not a whole lot that we know, but what we know is compelling. Tell our listeners what you think it's important for us to take away from Patrick Kennedy.
Yeah, well, you touched on one of the interesting aspects of who he was. He was the first and only in his immediate family to leave. He grew up on a farm a few miles away from the farm where Bridget was born and raised, so they were both from County Wexford. I have visited that farm. Bridget's property is now just overgrown, and there's nothing on her property anymore, but the Kennedy family farm is still there, owned by descendants of that family. So I was able to visit and get a brief, you know, sort of a little taste of what it might have been like back in the day. You know, what's interesting about Patrick to me is he had, you know, a few brothers and a sister and grew up working on the farm. But he decided at some point in his teens or early 20s that he didn't want to just work on the farm. He wanted something else, and he found a job in the nearest town of New Roth, just up the street from his farm, and he learned how to make barrels. He worked at a brewery there and was a trainee as a cooper, as barrel makers were known, are known. And that skill gave him a little bit of a leg up. So when he decided to leave Ireland around the same time as Bridget, comes to Boston, he has something that a lot of Irish immigrants at the time didn't. He had a skill that would help him find employment, and that's what he did. So he ended up in East Boston. He and Bridget both ended up there, and he found job as a barrel maker, which kept him and his wife, you know, in maybe slightly better circumstances than some of the others they were working alongside, living alongside, who many of them were just working manual labor jobs, digging ditches, digging the tunnels that were starting to sluice through Boston, or digging the railroads. So Patrick had a little bit more going on for himself, but I think, just like Bridget, it says something about his character that he was willing to take the chance and be the first family member to leave and start fresh somewhere else. I wish we knew more about him, and like you said, I wish we had a picture of him. But poor immigrants, they just didn't leave behind their collected papers.
Sadly, Patrick Kennedy falls ill to a disease that was running rampant in Boston, namely consumption. And he ultimately dies on the 22nd of November, which is, of course, the same date that would be the day that his great-grandson, John F. Kennedy, dies from an assassin's bullet. And one of the things that's especially poignant is that as Patrick Kennedy is dying of consumption, Bridget gives birth to the last of their children, and that would be Patrick Jr., or P.J. Kennedy. And it's just heartbreaking to think about what that must have been like for yet another child to be born, another hungry mouth to feed at a time when the head of the household, the husband, is deteriorating before her eyes. But she goes on from there. In fact, that's one of the most remarkable things about Bridget's story, is her resiliency in the wake of her husband's death.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's been overlooked in the sort of the saga of the Kennedy story. you know, if you picture her, that we talked about, that day when she's burying Patrick and she's got little PJ in her arms and three terrified daughters by her side, the family could have ended right there. You know, so many poor Irish kids, fatherless or motherless or orphaned, were scooped up and taken away, you know, sent. There's a tidbit in the book about the orphan trains where Irish kids were snatched by, you know, do-gooder missionaries who wanted to save them from their poor circumstances and put them on a train and sent them west to be adopted by farm families. That could have easily happened to PJ or Bridget's daughters. But she fought to keep them together as a family, and remarkably somehow worked her way up from the lowest level job of being a maid, and in time found work as a hairdresser in a department store in downtown Boston, which was the first significant step for her kind of out of the muck and toward what would become middle-class respectability eventually.
Right, and eventually owning her own shop. And it's just an incredible story, and you tell it with as much detail as is possible to know. and of course, it sets the stage for the remarkable rise of her young son, Patrick, or P.J. Kennedy. And I kind of knew this would happen, that there was so much to talk about with Bridget that it leaves us very little time to even sketch the remarkable life of P.J. Kennedy. But in a nutshell, I'm afraid, just describe kind of this amazing ascent that we see with P.J. Kennedy into a life that, for instance, his own father could scarcely have imagined for his son.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, he's another remarkable character. And I guess I would say the book is essentially divided into two halves. The first half is the remarkable ascent of Bridget Kennedy, and then the second half is the equally remarkable ascent of her son. Born poor and fatherless, gets into trouble as a young kid, starts working like many boys his age did, working on the docks of East Boston as a longshoreman and then a stevedore, and that could have been the life for him, just a backbreaking work and an early grave. But somehow he had something else going on there. He becomes a saloon owner at a relatively young age, probably with money loaned from his mother, who was a success by that time. He buys another saloon. He gets involved in local politics in his ward in East Boston. And then in time rises to become state legislator. Just, you know, within one generation, he is suddenly in a position to be an influential politician and help the lives of his constituents in ways that, like you said, his father, his parents could never have imagined when they arrived here. So PJ becomes, again, in a nutshell, a significant and powerful politician during his day, working alongside John F. Fitzgerald, who's the other grandfather of JFK and the other Kennedys. So the story there I find fascinating, and it's a great also sort of prelude to the story of the Kennedys that we think we know, this sort of ascent of PJ into an influential and really popular and successful politician and businessman, and also a wealthy bank owner and coal business owner, and his success helps set the stage for his son Joe to go to Harvard, and then lift the family even further out of their circumstances.
In this last minute, one of the points you make about PJ Kennedy is he was essentially raised by and surrounded by strong, resilient Irish women. There were almost no men whatsoever, at least in terms of the family tree, in a position to raise him. Do you have any guess in terms of what kind of effect that had in terms of shaping who he was and how he saw the world?
Yeah, I do have my theories, and some of it's backed by the research. You know, looping back to something we talked about earlier, the PJ Kennedy papers, I think you see the influence that Bridget and the other women in his life had on PJ in the words that are contained in the letters that he writes. He's a compassionate, empathetic man, and in fact there's a comment from another politician from the family, the period that I write about, who says it's remarkable that, in a nutshell, that PJ never got in trouble. You know, his heart was always actually in the right place. So many other Irish Democratic politicians from that period of time in the early 1900s got involved in scandals. John Fitzgerald, you know, had an affair that derailed his political career. But PJ stayed true and, as far as we can tell, honest and never got in trouble throughout his political and business career. And during that time, he's always working to help others, help them find a job, giving people money. In fact, one of his daughters later comments that he gave away too much money, that he was, you know, a little bit too generous, and that the family would have ended up with more had he not been so free with his handouts. But I think a lot of that generosity and empathy comes from his mother and the other women who raised and influenced him. And I think some of that trickles down through the rest of the family. I argue in the book that it probably skips the generation of Joe Kennedy, who was not known for those traits. But you see it in Joe's children, and examples like the Special Olympics that were created, you know, with the help of Eunice Kennedy and some of the other efforts by those members of the family. I think you can trace those back to PJ and further back to the influence of Bridget.
It's an incredible story and a beautifully written book. Again, it's titled The First Kennedys, The Humble Roots of an American Dynasty, published by Mariner Books. And for as lengthy as this conversation has been and as thorough, we have just scratched the surface in terms of all that a reader will find in these vivid pages. The author, Neil Thompson. Neil Thompson, congratulations on this marvelous book, and thank you so much for being my guest on The Morning Show. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Same here. Thanks for spending the time talking with me about the book, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, joins me in the studio to offer his analysis of current events, including the escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine. On Friday, in honor of Black History Month, I replay a conversation with Rocco Constantino, the author of a book called Beyond Color's Barrier, which talks